Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Edward Elgar, brilliant composer or imperialist relic? I'm John Schaefer, and today on Soundcheck, this year marks the 150th anniversary of the British composer, Sir Edward Elgar. But critics can't agree on whether to celebrate or not. Some say he embodies the worst of England's imperial past. Others point out that his remarkable life and music was a triumph of talent over prejudice. We'll have a debate. I'm the grand man. Later in the show, nearly 30 years into his songwriting career, Nick Cave is not going gracefully into musical maturity. He joins us to talk about a side project called Grinderman that explores an even darker side of his music, with songs about sex and the middle-aged man, and Filipino hip-hop made in Queens. All of that on Soundcheck. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The U.S. economy grew at a 3.4% pace in the second quarter, the gross domestic product's strongest showing in more than a year. But analysts are keeping a close eye on Wall Street today, where the stock continues to show declines a day after suffering its second worst day of the year. Art Hogan, chief market analyst with Jefferies & Company, says the market was due for a pullback.
You know, if you look back over the last 12 months, the Dow coming into yesterday had been up about 25%. Coming into today, it was up about 10% on a year-to-date basis. So you have to rationalize the kind of gains you've had with the fundamental backdrop. And I think that, you know, you make new highs, you're bound to get volatility.
The Dow is now down about 79 points at 13,394, with the Nasdaq down nearly 14 at 2585. The White House is publicly standing by Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, who's under fire by lawmakers. Several Democrats want a special prosecutor to investigate whether Gonzalez perjured himself. When asked this week about the administration's warrantless wiretapping program and his role in the dismissals of U.S. attorneys, NPR's David Green has this from the White House.
At issue is a debate back in 2004 over the government's wiretapping program. On Capitol Hill this week, Attorney General Gonzalez insisted that top officials in the Bush administration were all in agreement that the program was legal. But 2 days later, FBI Director Robert Mueller suggested the program was exactly what officials were fighting over in 2004, when there were threats of resignation and even a bedside hospital visit to then-Attorney General John Ashcroft to get his sign-off for the program. White House spokeswoman Dana Perino was asked about the apparent discrepancy between Gonzalez and Mueller. She said Gonzalez was in a tough spot when he testified because the program is classified, and as she put it, the attorney general was testifying with one hand tied behind his back. She said the president supports Gonzalez, and she accused Democrats of being on a crusade to destroy the attorney general. David Green, NPR News, The White House.
U.S. troops clash with militiamen loyal to the anti-American cleric Muqtada al-Sadr in Iraq's holy city of Karbala. Four gunmen along with five civilians were killed. More than 20 were wounded. From Baghdad, NPR's Joel Riddle has details.
The firefight started when the American military, in tandem with the Iraqi army, conducted an early morning raid on a house occupied by a Mehdi army leader. After a two-hour battle, U.S. soldiers surrounded a local hospital where it was thought the gunmen were seeking treatment. Karbala's governor denounced the raid, claiming the U.S. failed to get local Iraqi approval, and all roads coming and going from the city have been shut down. Baghdad was mostly quiet. The city is under mid-afternoon curfew every Friday. The calm was in stark contrast to the day before, when a truck bomb exploded in a mixed neighborhood, killing at least 30 and wounding more than 100. Joel Riddle, NPR News, Baghdad.
From Washington, this is NPR News.
WNYC New York, 79 degrees now, partly sunny skies at 204. A week after his funeral, Officer Russell Timoshenko was promoted to the rank of detective at a special ceremony at One Police Plaza. His family sat in the front row of the auditorium, and Mayor Bloomberg and Police Commissioner Kelly presented his parents with his gold shield. Timoshenko's cousin, Anastasia Apanasik, says it's bittersweet.
Today is a great celebration, but of course, it would have been much more happier if Russell was here with us to share this promotion. We know he worked so hard, and he always wanted to be a police officer.
The 23-year-old was shot this month after he and his partner pulled over a stolen SUV in Brooklyn. Officer Herman Yan was shot and wounded, and he was also promoted to detective today. Three men are being charged in the case. Police investigating a fiery crash that left six people dead have tentatively identified five of the victims as members of a Bronx family originally from Trinidad. The six were killed when their car crossed a median near Suffolk, Virginia, and crashed head-on into a truck. Governor Spitzer has announced a program that will offer homeowners with risky mortgages the opportunity to refinance and avoid possible foreclosure. Under the plan, the state will offer at-risk homeowners the ability to refinance their current mortgages with 30-year or 40-year fixed-rate mortgages at competitive interest rates. The aging United Nations headquarters will undergo a $1 billion makeover. The first-ever overhaul is aimed at bringing the landmarked but leaking glass and steel complex into compliance with safety and fire codes. The 7-year project is due to begin this fall. Partly to mostly cloudy skies tonight with scattered thunderstorms, low near 70. Right now in Central Park, 79 degrees and partly sunny. WNYC New York at 2:06.
Support for NPR comes from Travelocity, with customer support available all trip long, so you'll never roam alone. Travelocity.com or 1-888-TRAVELOCITY.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Later on today's show, singer-songwriter Nick Cave talks about sex and middle age, but we begin with the 150th anniversary this year of Sir Edward Elgar, the composer of this familiar music, Pomp and Circumstance. But it's also the year that the Bank of England has removed Elgar from the £20 note, and a debate has been raging about his true musical talent. Was he a truly original composer, or was he a parochial relic, a symbol of England's imperialist past? Joining us for some perspective on this debate is Leon Botstein, the president of Bard College, conductor, and the man behind next month's Bard Music Festival, which this year is called Elgar and His World. Also joining us is the British cultural critic Norman Lebrecht, whose latest book is The Life and Death of Classical Music. Norman's on the phone with us from London. And Norman, I will start with you. The traditional view of Elgar has been that this guy in the late 19th century almost single-handedly put England on the musical map after the 200 years since Purcell's death, when it seemed like nothing was happening. Isn't that the mark of a really great composer?
No, it's the mark of somebody who breaks a drought. I mean, the English musical drought, the idea of England as a land without music, really extends from the death of Handel in 1759. Handel was such a huge figure that he crushed the life out of English composers, and for the next 150 years, none of them really rose up to any kind of international standard. And then the vast presence of Mendelssohn in the 1830s and 1840s in England further served to depress musical creativity. They simply couldn't match that sort of thing. So Elgar was in the right place at the right time and came up with the right work. And in 1899, with Enigma Variations, he produced a work that instantly appealed to conductors. Its form was familiar, it was easily programmable, and it was taken up all over the world. Hans Richter, the great German conductor, was the first to acclaim it. Richard Strauss took it on, Arthur Nikisch. And so there was this perception of an English musical revival that stemmed from Elgar, and that perception, yes, still prevails unto this day. But it is, for reasons that I'm sure we're going to discuss, not the only side of the story. It is partly false.
Okay. Leon Botstein, I'm going to assume that you disagree with Norman, otherwise you wouldn't be putting together this 3-weekend festival with panels and symposia and concerts dealing with Elgar and his world. What is it about Elgar that attracted you to him for this year's Bard Music Festival?
Well, I don't disagree with Mr. Lebrecht's account of how Elgar came on the scene. I'm not really, in love with the question about evaluating a composer as if he were in a beauty contest. Elgar is undoubtedly an important figure in the sort of history of late 19th century and 20th century English music. So the festival is really opening the very question you started with. You know, what are we to make of this figure of undoubtable importance? And with a tremendous variety of work, some of it, I think, is really quite fantastic, including the Enigma Variations. He's not original in the sense of a path-breaking originality, as we might associate with Schoenberg or Stravinsky. But there's a tremendous amount, I think, of good music that is really first-rate and filled with complex, both compositional and emotional significance. And it's worth taking a look at, and it's worth taking a look at his contemporaries, because this notion of England as having a big drought is certainly right if you take it from a very distant perspective. But there are a lot of good composers, both his contemporaries, immediate successors, and some predecessors.
All right, we're speaking with Leon Botstein, who's running the Bard Music Festival this year, focusing on Sir Edward Elgar, and with Norman Lebrecht, whose latest book is The Life and Death of Classical Music. And we're talking about the significance of Sir Edward Elgar in his sesquicentennial year, his 150th anniversary. Norman, just from reading some of the things that are in the British press these days, it seems like you can't have a conversation about Elgar in England without politics somehow creeping into it. You know, the idea that he is a symbol of imperialism, of the imperial past of Great Britain.
John, that's absolutely right. Standing where I am in the center of London, you cannot have a non-contentious conversation about Elgar. There are those who claim him as the quintessence of Englishness, and others who will claim him as the quintessence of imperialism. The general consensus in England is that he is a great composer, and I'm some way out on a limb in saying, no, he isn't. He's a composer of three important works. He's a composer who made a absolutely vital breakthrough. He is an icebreaker. But aside from those three works, his significance beyond the shores of this island is really quite limited. And if you want proof of that, you will find that apart from Mr. Botstein's festival at Bard, there is very little going on around the world for Elgar's sesquicentennial. Not just around the world, there's nothing going on in Scotland.
But the Scots
have taken a very, very clear view that Elgar is a composer of limited interest, and more than that, one who is identified entirely in their minds with English imperialism. And he was a creature of that period. You cannot escape that with Pomp and Circumstance, which you played at the beginning of the show. Arouses instantly those evocation of the great red line that England spread around the world between the middle of the 18th century and the middle of the 20th.
All right, Norman, let me give Leon a chance to respond.
First of all, there's no doubt there's a side of Elgar which is a kind of pompous, imperial, somewhat embarrassing grandiosity. There's also an intimate Elgar which invented a kind of nostalgia for an English countryside, a pre-modern England, and there's also the Elgar that is engaged with things like the pre-Raphaelite aesthetics, with the religious questions having to do with the Oxford movement and Newman. It's a very complex question, but where I disagree with Norman Lebrecht is that there are not only three works that are worth hearing. And the fact that it's not known around the rest of the world is precisely why we're doing a festival. Because I think that Elgar has suffered in a way that some other composers have suffered, whether you think of Defaya or Szymanowski, or the best case of breaking out of this mold is Janáček, who was once a regional figure and became an international figure. The question is, can this be done with Elgar? Norman Lebrecht is correct that up to now, the interest in Elgar is very limited. Even a great work like The Dream of Drama has little traction outside of England. The question is that really right? I mean, there are some of these works, I think there are more than three, that merit close scrutiny. The other thing, of course, is you do a festival to cut against the grain. You know, all the cliches of music history, some of them are right, some of them are not right.
All right, well, you've both mentioned the Enigma variations. That certainly has to be one of three or more great works that Elgar composed. Let's hear a little bit of Sir Adrian Bolt leading the London Symphony Orchestra. This actually is ranked among Norman Lebrecht's top 100 recorded milestones of the 20th century. Here's music by Sir Edward Elgar. just a little bit of the Enigma Variations, an early success story for Sir Edward Elgar, whose sesquicentennial we are celebrating, or at least we're marking it this year. Some people are celebrating. Leon Botstein, for example, who will be leading the Bard College annual Bard Music Festival on two more weekends in August and then bringing it here to New York in October. The festival this year called Elgar and His World. But we're also speaking with Norman Lebrecht, the London-based cultural critic. His latest book is The Life and Death of Classical Music, and Norman's not so sure how much celebrating there is to be
done. If I may, I mean, I think, you know, Norman said there were three works. You know, I think the two symphonies, I think of Falstaff in the South. You know, I think of not only Gerontius, but I think, you know, The Kingdom is worth a close look. These oratorios, which are a little bit strange as a genre for us. You know, the same, you know, take Mendelssohn, which Norman Lebrecht correctly says dominated English taste in the mid-19th century. The reality is that, you know, as we enter the 20th century, there are only a few Mendelssohn works which really had any traction. And I think it pays to take a second look, because maybe the cliché about what is really great in Mendelssohn is limited. And the case may be the same with Elgar, and that the eloquence you hear in this Nimrod variation, which, you know, has become very nationalized, there's a kind of restrained intimacy, a kind of eloquence, a kind of struggle. There's a lot of ambivalence. It's not so simple. And I think there's something to be said for this music.
Leon, do we as Americans approach Elgar with fresher ears than people in England, for whom the political, the idea of music somehow having imperialist baggage associated with it?
I think the Americans have very little acquaintance with Elgar, and to some extent there is always a small veneer of Americans who always like anything English. I don't happen, I'm not particularly an Anglophile or Anglophobic, but I do think that not a lot of the music is actually in the repertory.
Mm-hmm.
The two symphonies have entered a little bit, but it is certainly the choral music is practically unknown.
Right. Norman, you did say there were three great works, Enigma Variations. I'm going to assume the Cello Concerto is one of them.
That's right.
And then what's the third?
I agree entirely with Leon Botstein that it does pay to explore the unfamiliar. It also pays occasionally to put a bet on a long shot at 100-1. For those of us to whom Elgar is familiar, I would say, you know, perhaps it doesn't pay that much. Yes, in my view, there are three works of great concentration, great intensity, where every note on the page and every note in the air is worth its weight in gold. The Enigma Variations, where we heard the passage that we heard, Elgar wrote above that passage "nobil mente." He coined a term for its actual nobility, and the nobility was not that of aristocracy, but of the human spirit. And you feel that right the way through this tribute to friendship, or to the possibility of friendship, the possibility of connection between human souls. That's undeniably a great work. The Cello Concerto, which is a valediction, written at the end of the Second World War, as Elgar's wife is dying, is a work of the most irresistible poignancy and intensity. It's also one of the most difficult works to play for a cellist, because there are no rests at all for the soloists in the whole thing. The solo is at its start to the cello is at its start to finish, and that grips the attention like nothing else. I would say the Violin Concerto is a great work. There is also the Violin Sonata, another late work that is a fine piece. The problem with Elgar, the problem that I find with Elgar, is that in almost everything else, there are stretches of ennui. He writes great, long works. He writes The Dream of Gerontius, but there are passages in The Dream of Gerontius where if you went out and you had a drink, and you maybe put a flutter on a horse, and you came back, you would feel you hadn't missed anything.
Okay,
there are patches of the same in the two symphonies. This is a man of humble origins, of Catholic origins.
Right, and I wanted to ask you about that in a moment, but let's hear a little bit of the Elgar Cello Concerto in the great recording by Jacqueline Dupré. Just a little bit of Elgar's cello concerto, Jacqueline Dupre's recording is the 12th biggest selling classical album of all time. That also coming from Norman LeBrecht's latest book, The Life and Death of Classical Music.
May I interject here for a moment?
Leon Botstein, yes, by all means.
First of all, I don't agree with this boredom argument. I mean, everybody's boredom is a subjective matter. One could say this about Parsifal, it's what Stravinsky said about Parsifal. These are matters of taste. I don't think they're long stretches of unreal.
Oh, they're not matters of taste.
And
They're actually matters of the intensity and the originality of the writing of the piece. There are novels in which there are very long passages in which the writer shows no originality and is just using them as a span towards his next great idea.
I don't think it's a matter of taste.
The idiom of Elgar and the language of Elgar appeals more than others.
Hold on, they don't find these dull. Norman, hold on just a second. Let Leon finish his thought, and then I want to come back to you.
So I don't think they're large stretches of boredom. I also think that the writing that Elgar, I don't think, is that much of an outsider. I mean, he was immensely successful despite being a Catholic, and he became, master of the king's music. He was an obnoxious man, unfortunately. He sold his Galliano violin to buy a billiard table. He was a kind of more Catholic than the Pope himself in wanting to be the sort of symbol of a country gentleman. Now, you have to put all that aside and say whether there is, there's a lot of intimacy written into this music. A lot of it, I think Falstaff is a terrific tone poem. In the South is a terrific one. Strauss admired him, and he was no fool. And George Bernard Shaw was maybe not the most discerning critic from my point of view, but also thought well of him. This is an open question whether it's only three works.
Well, it is an open question, and this is a good time to be asking it. Elgar's Sesquicentennial. Leon Botstein is producing the Bard Music Festival, Elgar and His World, on consecutive weekends, August 10th, August 17th, in Annandale on Hudson, upstate, bringing it to New York in October. And we've been speaking with him, also with Norman LeBrecht. The Life and Death of Classical Music is Norman's latest book. And, gentlemen, I think we'll just have to leave it with, there's an anniversary. We'll see if it can change either of your points of view or the world's view of Elgar. And in the meantime, let me thank you both for being with us on Soundcheck today.
John, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
And coming up next, from England's national composer to multicultural New York, we'll get a report on Filipino rap in Queens. And then later, Nick Cave's new band, Grinderman, is getting lots of buzz after opening for the White Stripes earlier this week. We'll find out why when he joins us later. This is Soundcheck.